as discussed, I am tired.
Last week, you became really, rarely, like, yeah, kind of disgruntled Joe. Like, you, when you were talking about films, like when you started talking about The Founder, like, you really went hard on it, which I'm not saying it didn't deserve, but yeah, I definitely felt like a different like you were playing a different instrument.
Hang on a second. Because you like that bit you were saying about instrument. I'm sorry. What about my instrument?
You were playing a different instrument. I liked it because you don't want to be Mr. Saxophone. You've been sax before. Very tenor sax, smooth against my kind of atonal cymbal crashing.
Sure.
And then, I'm just saying, you know, did I catch you? Did we catch you on a bad day? You were good. You were great last week. I think the role models episode.
Thanks.
Oh, it's up there.
I think I'm having a bad Q4, you know? So,
Yeah. And I mean, it's lovely that you refer to it. It is Q, you know, Q something.
Yeah. A cue up me being happier in the future.
You're in the same chair you've been in all day, and we haven't got to get up and leave. I've got to get up and leave. I've headed into the trolley room.
Oh mate, you've gone trolley room. I wish I had my own trolley room here in my house where I could go in the room, and then magical trolley woman would come around and say, anything from the trolley, dears? And I'd say, have you got any paracetamol, trolley woman? Plus a Jaffa cake, please.
And on my second can of Stella, I had an all-day breakfast sandwich for dinner. I feel fucking fantastic. I love
you. You are a rebel, man. You don't play by the rules of society, do you? You take food that's intended for a specific part of the day and you say, wow, Mr. Man, don't look at me twice. Don't sue me, but I'm going to eat that at a different time of the day.
Well, all day breakfast. All day. All day.
That's true. The marketeers actually already beat you to the punch, didn't they? You thought you were being clever.
No, I didn't think I was being clever. I thought it was funny.
So what you're saying is you're the man? Is it you? Are you the
I'm
man?
No, but look, I can't
Are
be the
my man.
Man. I came into town, I'm on second can of Stella, and I had a sandwich for dinner. I'm
I
not
can't
the
be
man.
The man. I came into town.
I'm buying branded goods. And I'm not.
I'm buying branded goods.
Branded beers. I'm not going to be despondent about that.
You're more the man than someone else, though, aren't you? Like, you're are you more the man than me? I think you are.
We're talking. You see, I've misunderstood. When you say the man, you mean like Billy Big Balls?
No. I mean the man.
You mean like the man, as in the man who controls people? The man.
Yeah, the man. I mean, you know, the arbiter of society, the director, the one to whom we owe our allegiance, you know, the one who directs our behaviour, the man. You know what I'm saying, the man.
Yeah.
So in that regard, do you think you're more the man? I think you might be more the man. You have a family.
But I don't, no. I mean, let's not dig into, like, modes of power and who's controlled and who's controlling.
You have a car. Does that make you more the man?
No, the man is, like, the police and, like, and government and state.
If one of us was to be police, which one would it be more likely to be?
I'd love to be the man. I'd love to make people pick up their litter.
You could be the litter man.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello. Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast, the show in which we chat about the films we'd forgot we'd even seen in the first place. Joining me, as ever, is the old leaky bucket boy. He's the man who pops the cinematic brew on, he lets it stew, and then he doesn't even drink it because it's stewed, and then he just pours it down the sink, and he doesn't like it, and then he just puts on Games of... and then he just drinks a hot milkshake of Game of Thrones instead. It's Mr. Joe Devine.
That's true. I don't like hot drinks, you know. I'm one of those adults that still doesn't drink tea or coffee in my 30s. And whenever I go out with someone I don't really know or a proper adult and they go, do you want a cup of tea? Do you want a coffee? And I go, can I have a Coca-Cola, please? I always feel like a right little scumbag, you know, like a sugary little ball boy.
But you shouldn't. That's just the shame that exists in you.
Yes.
On today's episode, we are doing 2021's Dune. Dune.
No, there's no J in there. It's Dune. All Dune.
Yeah, it's not called Dune, which Dune? Is what I call it. Dune. If you were just to say it without thinking, what would you say it?
June.
Yeah.
But I'm always thinking. Try it like this. Say, do you oon?
Do you oon?
And then put it all together.
Dune.
There you go.
Do you oon? Sand dunes.
Sand dune.
It's got a marvelous font. It's just the same shape inverted and played around with.
Right. Yeah. Dune. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that. What you're saying is it's a backward C. And then an upside up an up, C, and then a downward U. C, and then a C.
It's a backward.
But,
it's
but
a
the
backward
C. Is supposed
C
to be an E.
A usual U, a no, usual no, no, N, no, and then no, a normal
and
C.
And then a normal C. But this is the funny thing: is that the thing I think is so special about the C in this Dune. This is the logo of the film Dune, by the way, that we're talking about.
Yeah.
The thing I think so great about it is they've managed to get away with it, and you can see the word Dune. That's what it says to you, right? There isn't even the letter C in the word dune, but they've used the letter C. You know?
There's no getting away with it. It's fantastic.
It's fantastic to put the letter C in a word that isn't even in. I mean, that honestly, I think that's very smart that it works that way.
Well, they've added a little. There's a little like burst of. There's a little dot where the you would kind of have the middle of the E.
Yeah, because otherwise it looks like it says dunk.
Yeah, this is the 2021. Denis Villeneuve directed flick, adapted from the Frank Herbert novel of the same name. The book's called Dune. It's not called Frank Herbert, for God's sake.
Did that joke survive the last term?
Mate, that joke. Whenever we've got any book, any film that's been adapted, you will be hearing my joke. It stars Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides, and also it's what a hell of a cast: Rebecca Ferguson, Oscar Isaac, Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård, Dave Bautista. It features Zendaya. To say it stars Zendaya is ludicrous. Jason Momoa.
Did you call him Bautista?
Bautista. How do you call him?
Dave Bautista.
Bautista. Bautista.
Teast. I would Bautista. Say teast, but you say tist.
Well, it's an I there, isn't it?
Yeah, but he was a wrestler, wasn't he, Bautista?
I have no idea.
And I'm pretty sure they all said Batiste. But I quite like Batista. Dave Bautista. I quite like
Bautista.
That.
Bautista. Yeah,
that's quite fun.
Hell of a cast.
Hell of a cast.
It's 155 mins.
Yeah, it's quite long.
That's 2.5. That's over. Is that over 2.5 hours long? I don't know.
155 mins. It is over 2.5 hours long because 150 mins is 2.5 hours.
This intro is almost as long as the film itself. Let's get to the letterboxed. Beyond fear, destiny awaits. Paul Atreides, a brilliant and gifted young man born into a great destiny beyond his understanding, must travel to the most dangerous planet in the universe to ensure the future of his family and his people. As malevolent forces explode into conflict over the planet's exclusive supply of the most precious resource in existence, a commodity capable of unlocking humanity's greatest potential. Only those who can conquer their fear will survive.
Anything off the trolley, dears?
Yeah, there she is. That's
Do you
fine.
Think she's selling spice? Hope so.
The commodity of which they speak there, Joe says it. It's called in the book Melange, also spice. It gets a bit of a back seat in the movie.
Have you read the book?
I have read the first I've basically read where the film ends.
That's great, because someone I spoke to yesterday, when I told them we were doing Dune, they said they were very excited to listen to Adam because they expected that you would have the book in your house.
I do have the book in my house.
Okay.
And I read up to the point, this is before I knew the film was going to be made. I do like sci-fi, although I would say this is more sci-fi fantasy.
Agree.
Although there are spaceships.
Well, we're talking space opera, aren't we?
We are. Oh, man, there's so many things to unpick. I don't even know where to dig in. I do have the book in my house. I'd read up to... There is this neat midpoint, which is kind of where the film... The first part... This is part one, for God's sake. This is part one, and that's where the end... That's where
I
saw...
What is that trolley lady doing, though? Seriously, is she... What kind of goods is she selling? Because I know when you do record on the Hogwarts Express, it can be a bit complicated, but I've never heard her around for so long.
They're just like, she's cleaning up.
She's cleaning up.
She's not
delivering.
I thought
she only sold magical goods. Does she clean up as well?
No one is listening thinking she sells chocolate frogs.
Because I assumed that the Hogwarts Express would have house elves that would do the cleaning, but are you saying she's mucking in?
Let's just keep the mystery, all right? Let's just keep the mystery of who the trolley lady is. You've completely derailed me, much like that trolley lady has.
Anything off the trolley, dears?
Now I have obviously read the book, but not to completion. I've read as much of the book as there is of the film.
Not to completion. So, come on, mate. You can't say that about a book.
Well, the film's not to completion, so why should
I... No, I'm saying the term not to completion is only ever used in reference to orgasms. You know,
I can use it, and I do use it.
And I do can, and I'm going to use it more now you've said that.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using it in all sorts of conversations. Are you enjoying your lunch? Yes, I am, but I haven't enjoyed it to completion yet.
There you go. What a great sentence.
Yeah. And then stare deeply into their eyes when you say that.
Let's get through the good bits.
Yeah.
This looks amazing.
Yes.
It's unparalleled how gorgeous and what a vision this is.
You think it's unparalleled?
I do think so, in terms of specifically this world... it's considered an unfilmable novel.
Right.
David Lynch himself... really floundered about trying to make it. And also, because it's such a fat story, it's a fat book, it does a good job of concision, pulling together a simple story for that first half of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the story is too simple. Why people like the book so much is it's very dense. It's a real world-buildy novel. There's so much detail about the houses and about what's going on. One scene, just between two people, could just go on for pages and pages and pages. So in that, the fact that they've just managed to wrangle something that's compelling, followable, is fairly impressive.
It's still a little tough to follow, and I have to say that this, as a second viewing, I enjoyed it a lot more than the first time because I could understand a bit more of what was happening.
What had you not understood?
I feel this way when I watch any of those kind of big action adventure films where, any of the large action related scenes are interspersed with scenes where people are kind of talking a bit quietly or mumbling a bit. Or saying things a bit that I sort of go, oh, I don't know what they're talking about, you know. So the plot, I was confused about the plot. I was confused about who was attacking them the first time round. Yeah. I didn't get that there was like some kind of thing with the Empire, because the intro sets it up as though the Emperor would be afraid of the bad people. So that kind of confused me. I don't really get like why everyone on Dune seems to know who Timothy Chalamet is already before he arrives.
I could tell you that.
Well, I'm sure you could. I'm not saying the film doesn't express it. I'm just saying that as a kind of mid-level, a moderate follower of plots, when I watch a film, I think I have to, and I'm a supporter of this, I think that's fine, but I do have to watch it a bit harder to understand what's happening. So that, for that reason, I enjoyed it a lot more in the second time, because those things mostly became quite clear.
Do you get now why they follow him?
Because they've been told for years that someone's coming to save them, and they have all these myths around it, and then his mother's tribe of witch women have sort of gone there ahead of time and spread rumours that it's him.
My source on Dune, my brother-in-law Rick, told me, I'd kind of overlooked it, that these witches, the Bene Gesserit, they're basically massively into eugenics, because they've been just pairing up women with powerful men to kind of create all-powerful, clever little lad.
Yeah.
So that's not nice, is it?
No, not really.
Sort of kind of gross, isn't it?
This is the other thing about watching this film. Timothy Chalamet's character, Mr. Dune, he's great, right? Pretty cool, good fighter, is a sort of a show-off, has magical powers. He's your typical fantasy protagonist. He can do
everything.
He's
the one.
He's the one. Everything he does it really well. But guess what? Mummy's on the trip. And the scenes where they're sort of walking together towards the end in the desert with the big group that they're in, and the journey's started in earnest, and the fellowship have been brought together, and they're on the way to Mordor. You get what I'm saying? You really go, you watch it and you go, oh yeah, there's not that many films where you have a character like this, a protagonist who is joining up with their crew and setting sail on their new adventure. But guess what? Mummy's there too. And I love my mother, but if I was Mr. Dune, I wouldn't want Mummy on the travel with me. I'd want to be there on my own, because I'm a man. You know what I'm saying?
That's very funny. I love the phrase, Mummy's on the trip too. interesting, you should bring up Fellowship. J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes.
He did not care for Dune. In fact, he said he didn't say detest. He said he used a very strong word to say he didn't like it. Someone asked him to review it, and he said, no, I can't review it because Frank Herbert's still working and still writing. It wouldn't be fair. But I really didn't like this book, which I found interesting. There are various suppositions online as to why he didn't.
What did they say?
They speak about Tolkien was obviously a man of faith and religion, and this film is sort of positions religion as a tool of control. And J.R.R., he wouldn't have been up for that. He's about, someone said as well, no, these are not my ideas. The person writing said that Tolkien was very much about the hero, about kind of honourable men trying their best. And the characters in Dune, there's a lot more cynicism and power and control bringing the worst out of people. These are suppositions.
I have some suppositions as well.
Yeah, yeah. Go on. Let's suppose why Tolkien would not have cared for the book and probably the film Dune.
There are some key differences. I mean, you know, Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, often cited as the sort of, you know, the archetypal high fantasy that many have followed since. I do think that when you take Frodo as the protagonist character of Lord of the Rings, Frodo is not your typical high fantasy protagonist. His one thing that he has is his determination. And I guess his second thing is he's got some kind of like inbuilt immunity to the ring. But that seems like it's part of being a hobbit as well, right? So whilst he's 100% a hero...
You tell me, is that
yeah,
right?
It seems like it's part of just him being a hobbit. Yeah. So whilst he is a hero, it's also worth saying that he's a hero for just being determined and being able to see something through. And he doesn't have all of the incredible skills that other high fantasy protagonists do have, like Timothy Chalamet in Dune. So I think one thing that that Tolkien might not have liked about it is that the protagonist seems a little more two-dimensional in some ways there. The other thing that he really won't have liked about it, Ain't no orcs, yeah? Where's the elves at? Where da big trees gone? Do you know what I'm saying? Because there are so many fun little creatures, aren't there? A lot of fun creatures, you call them. Sometimes they're evil. Sometimes they're good. Spiders, evil. Snakes, evil. Little rabbits, good. You know what I'm saying? Elves, sort of confusing, but mostly good. And I think he would have said to Dune, Dune, you had so much potential here. Why didn't you just make the Harkonnens orcs?
Wait! Stop! Stop! Turn around! Turn around, take a step!
You know, what do you think the film is about?
Dune.
Like, what do you think the film Dune is about? Like, what are the themes of it? Because I can tell you what the themes of the book are. And when I read what the themes of the book are, I thought, hang on a sec, I don't think this is a good adaptation.
Right.
Because I don't think this is what the film is about. So you tell me.
Worms. I think it's about big worms. I think it's about power and control,
right?
And machinations. I think it's about about politicking and the stress that external societal structures can have on family life.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be clever. You could just tell me what you really think it's about.
I can't help but be clever. I'm very sorry, Adam. That's just one of my it's one of the, my issues.
Try though. You're trying.
Try not to be clever.
Well, you're not, no, because you're not clever. You just say
let
something
me try
true.
Again. Set it up for me again, just, and let just, me try.
Just don't be a smart ass.
No, help me, help me.
I'm not trying to help you. Just like, did you believe that answer?
Do I believe my answer? What did
or
I say?
Were you just reaching? You said
I'm 100% reaching all the time. But let me try one more time. I'm going to try again.
What do you think the film's about?
I think the film is about worms.
Okay.
No, I need so more says, time. Hold
no,
on.
Fine.
No,
wait, we'll get no, it's fine. No, you're not going to get
stay.
This isn't
I've got
it's
it.
Not
Hold
a test.
On.
It's
this
not
is good.
A test.
No,
you
no,
haven't
no,
lost.
This bit's good. Hold on. Let me get. I've got it. I know what the film's about. I know what the film is about now. Ask me one more time.
What is the film about?
I think the film it's about worms.
Right. So the book is a complex and multi-layered work that explores themes around cultural and historical development, religion, ecology, and human nature.
Wait, I thought we weren't allowed to be clever.
No, these aren't my words.
Oh, fine. Okay.
I've got to stop saying for God's sake.
For God's sake.
And human nature. At its core, however, the novel is a cautionary tale about the dangers of ambition and the corrupting influence of power. Now, I know that is about, that's the full book.
Uh-huh.
And we haven't completed the full book.
No.
Because we're only halfway through the film.
Yes.
Now, the second one comes out in March.
Mm.
Do you think the second film is going to pay off on that idea of corrupting power? I'm going to lay it down on the line. I do not think the films are going to be about the idea of, you know, about power corrupting Paul Atreides.
I would expect that they wouldn't be, as I think you know, a modern audience wouldn't enjoy an enormously expensive trilogy in that manner, right? I would have
this
thought
is only a
two-part prefer...
it's only going to be a two-parter.
Oh, is it only a two-parter?
He hopes to maybe get given a third, but this has purely been written and shot as a two-parter.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, well,
do you want to know what happens in the second part?
No.
Based on the book?
No, I don't want to know.
Even in broad strokes?
Well, I could probably guess.
Go on, you tell. Again, this is great. Guesswork. Guess.
Guess. Okay.
Guess. Well, you're obviously, because you've only seen the film.
The Fremen rise up, yeah? Led by Paul Atreides.
Oh, my
he
God.
He gets an army of 1 million people. They were
Where'd
very
you get your
surprised
ideas from?
How many people there were in the Fremen, because the Harkonnens thought there were only 50,000. But it turns out there's 1 million because, you know, it was just one cursory glance and they worked that out. Anyway, They're all, actually, it turns out, even though they're desert people, they are incredible warriors. And they're going to rise up under the tutelage of their god. And he is going to try and become the emperor and topple the emperor and be the emperor himself. And then he's going to have to make some kind of decision about whether he saves the Fremen and does what the Fremen were supposed to want him to do, or whether he takes the power, becomes the emperor, and then ultimately he does or doesn't make a decision which is or isn't good or bad.
Yeah.
Is that it?
No, not really. There's partly that there. Like, obviously, he's going to get swelled up with the Fremen.
Don't say obviously, because it makes me feel like that the one bit I got right was obvious and it wasn't special on my part.
Well, he did the end of the second of the film is he teams up with the Fremen.
Okay, but can you just say something like a bit of what I said was special?
But do you need your ego stroking?
Not my ego. I just want to feel like you respect me.
I do respect you.
Say it again.
I'll respect you when you say something that's not fucking so...
Oh, conditional respect. Conditional respect. Now I understand.
Listen, I'm not mummy, okay?
You are mummy. Daddy's and daddy.
Daddy's on the trip, not mummy.
Daddy's got to tell you what, a bit this film that did move me. Bit yeah. straight down the middle, isn't it?
Because really?
You know, it's a bit straight down the middle. But there's obviously Oscar Isaacs, who plays Timothy Chalamet's dad, Mr.
Here
June.
Here we go.
Yeah. When did Oscar Isaacs become daddy? But he's fantastic in the role.
Imagine if Oscar Isaac was our daddy.
I really wish he was my daddy. I wish anyone was my daddy. He's fantastic in the film. He dies in the film, and he dies in a sort of a big ruckus, a worldwide ruckus. So there isn't a lot of time to process that, you know? And then Timothy Chalamet and Mummy end up in a tent on the other side of the planet, safe for a bit of time. It's the first moment that there's been reprieve, a bit of respite, you know? And they're inside this hot tent under the sand, and Paul Atreides screams at his mother, "Get off me, mother! Get off me, mother!" and she backs away in fear, comes back in for another hug, and he looks at the ground and he says, "My father is dead." And it's the moment of realization. It's all this stress throughout that evening has just built up to the point, but he finally sees it. And it is at once an acknowledgement, an apology for shouting, an explanation for why he's sad. It is a recognition of the severity of the events that he's in. And it's a kind of look forward to the future. And just the way that Timothy Chalamet does it, it's a lovely little moment in a very big film, you know?
Yeah, it's a good moment. And I do...
I believe it.
Yeah, I think he's generally quite good in this. And then rewatching it, it is still... It just looks amazing. I love the director. The cast is fantastic. It's really brought this world to life. And yet, I just keep thinking, and it just... Because the story feels so simple and yet also a bit convoluted... It doesn't feel like there's enough story for 155 minutes.
Yes.
And I can't square that circle. Then it also feels like it's kind of got the machinations of all the houses, House Atreides, House Harkonnen. It feels very Game of Thrones.
Yes.
And the spice and the spaceship and the voice, the witches, the Bene Gesserit, they teach Timothée Chalamet this thing called the voice, where you can make people do what you say. Well, that's what that's the force. That's what Jedi's use.
Yeah.
So a lot of what exists in Dune in the book has kind of been it's been stripped for parts by other things, like your Star Warses, and I do think also like something like Game of Thrones. Even though George R.R.R.R. Martin was writing about it was a history, like War of the Roses or something.
Yeah.
It still feels like he's definitely read Dune, and I would, he's probably definitely read Dune.
It still feels like he's definitely read Dune.
I'm going to lay it on the line.
Yeah.
But so it feels like, and so those kinds of those political machinations you spoke of when you absolutely nailed what the film was about, they make sense played over a long time, over a TV series. And in a film, they have to be simplified, so they're kind of not that interesting. But then they're also kind of... They also whiz by.
Yes.
You know, so then you're just kind of left with just a spectacle.
I agree. Do you want to hear something fun, Adam?
I do. I just, after what I just said, I do.
I very recently, and just by happenstance, I didn't intend to because I didn't realise that Denis Villeneuve, how do you say his name?
Denis Villeneuve
was also the director of Blade Runner 2049. But I watched that about a week ago.
Really?
Yeah, I did, just by happenstance. And all I wrote about it was, gets better with each watch. And I wrote one quote, all the best memories are hers, which is the best line from that film. It's really fantastic. And I've forgotten about that bit of it. But the other thing is, it suffers from all of exactly the same things that you just described in Dune. It's this big, expansive film where on the surface of it, everything makes sense. The story does link together. There's enough pacing given to all the correct things. But it just feels a little, I don't know, something's missing. And I feel the same way about Dune. I think if I watched Dune again every year for the next 3 years, I'd like it most in 3 years' time. But there's just something about it that's not there.
I think it's going to slot together real nice, hopefully, with part two.
I hope so.
And they will sit together and you can watch them in, you know, you can break them down into hour and a half, 2 hour parts. What's that? You could do
six hours.
It will end up being 6 hours and you break it down into three parts. And I reckon it'll cut up real nice.
Sure.
Because of the world building, I was listening to the score on the way into town. You know, it's classic Zimmer. Mm-hmm. Why his scores are so great is they are fantastic afterwards when you realise, you know, you listen to them on their own. All of his Nolan stuff, you're not thinking, wow, that's an amazing bit of score because it fits the film you're in.
Yes.
And then afterwards, then you can then just listen to it by itself as a piece of music. So it's a fantastic score.
Well, if I may tie two themes together, Adam, on that note, I watched a fantastic interview earlier this year with Hans Zimmer talking about his score for The Lion King. And of course, it's interesting when you think about The Lion King because most people think about the Elton John songs, you know. But it really, for me, it's the score underneath that is the biggest musical achievement when it comes to The Lion King. He talked about it and he said, when he was offered the job in the first instance, he really wasn't that interested in taking it. But because his daughter was 5 years old at the time and all the other films that he was working on were these films that weren't appropriate to show her, he decided, okay, maybe he'll take The Lion King. But as soon as he got to grips with the story and realized what the story was about and about, you know, that it was about this young lion that was mourning the loss of his father, he realized, Hans Zimmer, who lost his father at an early age, that it was actually incredibly deeply meaningful to him. And he describes his score for The Lion King as an overture for his father. And when you listen to it in that context, it is fucking incredible to hear. Same thing that you were just describing. You know, you don't necessarily notice it apart from various peak moments within the film. But when you go back and look at it on its own and listen to it outside of that context, it's some of the best music I've ever heard.
He's top of the tree. You know, he pips John Williams, even, I'd say.
Yeah, what are John Williams, what are his top hits? I tell you what we'll do. Let me say films to you, and you tell me which one they've come from, yeah? Okay, welcome, Adam, to the game. Is that Zimmer or Williams, yeah? Now, I know you know all of the key ones, so if you want to list a couple of the most famous ones from each before we get started, now's your time to do that.
Well, you know, John Williams is obviously, you know, he's your Star Wars, he's your Jaws, he's Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, and, you know, Zimmer. Zimmer spans from stuff like even like Pirates of the Caribbean, but then, you know, the Nolan stuff, Inception, Interstellar, Dune. They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. That's absolutely right. Now, I'm going to pick some films that aren't everywhere and might be a little harder, but they are come from either John Williams or Hans Zimmer, and you're going to tell me. Are you ready to play?
I'm ready to play.
The film from 2016, Hidden Figures.
Oh, that's great, man. That is great. Because now I'm just trying to dig into who would bother.
Who would?
It feels tonally...
Tonally, I can see it does feel John like a John Williams film, tonally,
it does.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
But I don't know if he's bothering. I'm going to have to go against... I'm going to have to go Zimmer.
It is Hans Zimmer. Well done. Yes. That's one out of one so far. Okay. The 2011 film, Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows,
Zimmer.
With Robert
Zimmer.
Downey Jr. That is Zimmer.
I know it's Zimmer.
Well done for you.
The main theme tune, and it is the theme tune to Sherlock Holmes, is absolutely fantastic. It's so rollicking. It's absolutely...
It's rollicking.
It's rollicking.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, that's good news. What about this now? The 2005 film The Weatherman with Nicolas Cage. Zimmer or John Williams?
Well, I tried to get you on The Weatherman.
Yes, you did.
I'm going to go John Williams.
It's Hans Zimmer. It's your first one that's incorrect. Okay. Okay. The 2002 film, The Ring.
Yeah, starring Naomi Watts. I can't see John Williams doing a horror like that.
Is it Brand Williams? It doesn't sound like it.
It's Brand Zimmer.
Yeah.
I think Brand Zimmer.
Well done. Yes, it is. Okay, a couple more.
I love the fact that Brand Zimmer.
Brand Zimmer
like
is a thing.
Brand Zimmer.
Okay, the 90s, fantastic film now. Do you know what? We probably could have done this one. 1999, Angela's Ashes.
Never saw it.
Never saw it. Robbie Carlyle and Emily Watson.
Emily Watson.
I'm sorry.
Let me get it.
Emily Watson. She's terrific in that film. Terrific. As are the three different ages of the boy.
I find those films, they appear to be quite dreary.
Well, they're part of my heritage, Adam.
Is that the film I think it is?
Yeah, it's based on the very popular book, Angela's Ashes, but it's about the family, the young family who move back from New York to Ireland and struggle throughout their lives. I mean, it's just basically very sad.
John Williams.
It is John Williams. Yeah, well done. Well done. 1990, Presumed Innocent.
Oh.
With Harrison Ford.
Hey, listen, everyone could have been impressed when I said Harrison Ford. I know the plot of that movie. Also, I know the end. I know how it ends.
Well, bully for you that you know the plot and the ending, but do you know the score?
I think it's too sexy for John Williams, so I think Hans Zimmer.
You think it's Brand Zimmer?
I think it's Brand Zimmer.
It's John Williams.
Oh.
There you go. Congratulations. And one final one. 9 months with Hugh Grant. And who?
Julianne Moore.
There you go. Well done.
Yes,
well done.
Please.
1995, 9 months. Sounds Brand Williams, doesn't it? But is it?
It does. Robin Williams plays the comedic gynecologist, I think, doing a stupid accent.
Sure.
That film got absolutely panned. That was around the time where Hugh Grant got caught getting a blowy in LA.
Anyway, 9 months, the film 9 months from 1995.
I'm going to go Zimmer.
You're going Brand Zimmer? It is Zimmer. Oh, this is a fun game. I don't really want it to end, but I feel like it might have reached a natural conclusion. One more for a bonus point. 2005, Memoirs of a Geisha.
John Williams.
Oh, yeah, you got that one pretty easy, didn't you?
Here's what the old brother-in-law, Ricky T, had to say about Dune. And he's read the whole book. What I do remember from reading it was how much emphasis was put on the spice itself. It's complicated to adapt in the modern age, given that winners don't do drugs. Spice is essentially a performance-enhancing, conscious-expanding drug which bestows superhero powers on the hero so he can become the one. In enough quantities, it can be used to fold space and time. This idea of higher consciousness and fantasy abilities through drugs was a big takeaway for me at the time, and I felt that was probably due to the era in which the book was written. He's not wrong. In my little bit of research, Frank Herbert was very informed by psilocybin mushrooms. You are not going to get me on that. And he finishes off with, so the film pulls that punch. Spice is very much in the background of the film.
Yeah.
You get a little bit of Timothée getting spaced out by it.
You see that he has some kind of connection to the spice, some sensitivity to it.
But it's the crux of the book and what they're all fighting for. Mm. On rewatching, I miss the fact, I thought it kind of fueled the spaceships, but it doesn't. It basically means that the pilots can navigate through space and time.
Oh.
That's why it's important.
Hey.
It makes interstellar travel possible because the pilots need spice, because it kind of expands your mind to the point where you can, which is quite interesting.
That is interesting. I like that.
Yeah, so do I. But the film is kind of not interested in that at all.
It's the anti-Bourne legacy. Yeah? Where they take out the drugs that make the guys cool and they just say, these guys are cool on their own.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about that? I feel like maybe cinematically there's just no runway there.
Maybe not. I mean, do you remember the case of old Lance Armstrong?
No.
The cyclist. You remember that, right?
I mean, I do, but like, are we going to...
No, all I'm saying is that modern audiences hate Lance Armstrong. They hate him. They thought... Hey, here's this guy. He's an American. He's an all-American hero because he's on a bike and he goes faster than everybody else. And guess what? He stands up for and is a beacon of the American values of truth, justice, freedom, and speed. Those are the four key American values. And then when it came out that actually he was only a beacon for performance-enhancing drugs, which gave him a minor edge against other athletes who were all also probably taking performance-enhancing drugs, everybody went, no. No, Lance Armstrong. That's some BS, man. You told us it was all about the drugs that are naturally produced chemically in your body, not the ones that you were taking elsewhere. And also, when you take your blood out and spin it round really fast to oxygenate it and then put it back in, that's cheating, man, even though you're not introducing any external chemicals into your bloodstream. I don't know if he did that. I actually don't know what I'm talking about, so obviously don't take anything I'm saying for rote. But my point overall was that the American public was so heartbroken by... that he is American, isn't he? That you know, that I think
you've gone off. You've set off on this wobbly bike, and you're still going. I don't know how.
Yeah, I think still basically. Going.
Have you,
what
hey,
I'm
have
saying
you had some
is,
blood spinning?
Hold on,
have you done? You had your blood spun.
No, that's what I need to do. I need to have my blood spun, and then okay, okay, blood spun. Now it's going to my feet again. I can finally think. Now listen, what I'm saying is, people hate drugs, yeah? Guess what? The war on drugs, we won that war. People think we lost because they watch The Wire and they're all into propaganda. But no, we won it. And now Gen Zers, they hate drugs too. They don't even drink alcohol. So they're not going to watch their hero, Timothy Chalamet, taking drugs, Adam, because drugs are bad.
Ricky T ends with, what's left is an epic tapestry / opera. Ooh. With the uncomfortable but exciting point from the book set to low volume. In that regard, he means spice. Hoping nobody cares. I don't think necessarily Rick is right in that the spice is taken out. I mean, you've, on your whole Lance Armstrong riff, you're also suggesting that it was taken out for maybe the mores of the time.
I think it's just less compelling, isn't it? I mean, like, isn't it more interesting to watch a guy who is inherently special than it is to watch a guy who, like, takes some sand and then is better?
No, but because he's already been bred. He's been eugenically bred to be the one. He's already the one. This does definitely go back to our Bourne legacy argument.
It does. Is he the one, very, though? We're not sure if he's the one, are we?
He is the one.
Isn't being the one just like an imagination thing, and pretend, imaginary?
I think then maybe the latter, part two, will possibly deal with that.
Right.
And the nature and the problems with being the one.
Because that's Blade Runner 2049 as well. Guy thinks he's the one for the whole film. Turns out he's not the one.
Yeah, that'll probably be the end of Dune Part 2.
Mm.
But and kind of, it'll all be about checking his privilege.
Denis does it again.
Hey, hang on a sec. I'm very uncomfortable about being called the one. I don't think that's cool these days. Let's think about everyone else. You guys are the one. Everyone is the one.
Yeah.
Hey, see you later.
To be fair, everyone is the one, though, isn't they? Because I am the
isn't
one.
Everyone is the one, isn't they? Mate, you're fucking dumb. You're dumb. You can't even speak anymore.
I said that on purpose.
No, okay.
I thought it was funny. Everyone is the one, though, isn't they? I mean, that's surely that's the only grammatically correct way to say that sentence. Everyone is the one, though, isn't they? Because I'm the one. Are you the one? I mean, you're the one for you.
I'm not the one.
You're verging on the one for me.
Let's talk about the one trope.
Mm-hmm. Because Neo's the real one.
That's the film that gave the thing a name.
Yeah.
Did it begin the whole thing? Because you would say, arguably, Luke Skywalker is the one, even though he was never described as the one. He's the one in Star Wars.
Neoplatonism is a version of Platonic philosophy that emerged in the 3rd century AD against the background of Hellenistic philosophy and religion. The term does not encapsulate a set of ideas as much a series of thinkers. Among the common ideas it maintains is monism, the doctrine that all of reality can be derived from a single principle, the one.
That's not what we're talking about.
I know. I wanted to see how far I could get in the paragraph before you stopped me. But
I'm trying to let you speak more. It's excruciating sometimes. It's excruciating because it's excruciating sitting in and like reminding myself I have to listen.
Yeah,
I have to listen.
Sure.
Because sometimes, mm-hmm. not just sometimes, all the time, I don't. I've got nothing to say. I had to mentally head check.
No, I've got it. I've been Googling the one and then Googling fantasy books and stuff, and then it suddenly struck me without the need of Google, with the use of my own brain. Jesus, yeah? And then the history of all religion. I mean, they're all the ones, aren't they? From the beginning of monotheistic religions, was the one.
He was the one.
They're the first ones. And they do say that the Christian gods and the monotheistic religion gods are all based on gods from previous stories, or at the very least. There's this great bit of Bill Maher's film Religious, which came out, Religious, I think it's called.
Stupid pun.
Anyway, whatever Bill Maher's become now, made this film like 15 years ago, and there's a great section within that.
Stupid pun,
thank you.
I love puns.
Okay, but there's a fantastic section of that film, which is really just a great TikTok now. It's like a minute and a half, really fast-paced history of all of the ones that came before Jesus. So here's all the special stories about Jesus, like that he was a virgin, he was born to a virgin, right? And then here's all the gods before him in more ancient religious stories and doctrine that were gods that were also born of virgins. Like, here's one that rose on the third day. Oh, by the way, here's a bunch from like ancient Egypt, for example, that rose on the third day. All of the key parts of the Jesus story are lifted essentially from more ancient and historical religions. So the notion of the one stretches back all the way before monotheistic religions, but I suppose it becomes thematically relevant when the monotheistic religions start to take hold, because that's when we go from like 100 to one, yeah? All these different fun gods, now just one god.
They make it canon.
Yeah, they canonize it, absolutely. And they put Jesus at the very center of the one, although there are three, aren't there? Which is kind of confusing.
That's where that's the source of the well. You've nailed it. You cracked the code.
How about this? Here's another little fun thing. Because of the confusion of the Christian doctrine where Jesus and God, that they are the one, but also it's Jesus, God, and the Holy Spirit, and it's kind of confusing as to how they are three and one at the same time. What about this? The most recent Spider-Man, where Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield show up, yeah? They're kind of three in one, aren't they? Because they're all the ones in their world, but now there's three of them. So that's sort of the same thing.
Well, they do. That's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.
That's true.
So Tobey Maguire is very much the Father.
Yeah.
Tom Holland is the Son.
Yeah.
And Andrew Garfield, he's a ghost.
Yeah.
He's a weak little ghost, my friend.
Nothing holy about it.
Holy in that his performance was very, very holy. With a W, I mean. So, do you think Dune, the film...
Would it be with a W?
No, it wouldn't.
No.
It wouldn't. It would be with an H.
Yeah.
That would be something else. So, we'll cut, definitely cut that out.
No. I think that's like, that's prime for staying. Let's play the box office game, Adam. Okay, the budget, please, for the film Dune. Estimated Dune.
They're going to be spending a lot of money up front on part one. A lot of development money. Oh, the cast as well. So many special effects. This is going to be a big old budget. I don't even care.
It's a Billy Big Ball for sure.
I'm going to say 250 million.
Little bit of an overestimation there. The budget was $165 million.
That's a big old overestimation.
It is a big old overestimation. I wasn't going to say that, but you said it for yourself. So well done.
I was thinking they'd kind of filmed some of part two and I was adding on stuff. But do you know what? I've screwed the pooch.
No, not at all.
I fucked the dog.
You were thinking they actually filmed on a planet called Dune and the space costs would have been expensive. But no, they filmed it all on Earth, you'll be pleased to know. Now, opening weekend US and Canada, Adam. Bear in mind, of course, that this film was released on October the 24th, 2021.
Tricky business.
It is tricky business, isn't it? US and Canada.
This is a tricky business because...
It's just pre... 2 months prior Omicron. Yes, the coronavirus strand.
It had to open big. It had to because if you don't have a strong opening, you don't sustain.
Well,
and I know
that's not necessarily true. We've seen examples of other films that had slow openings and grew over time as critical
but those are
reception
masked. Not films like this. No.
Sure.
No. Well, okay. I think this has got to open big. It needs to open big. It's got to. It has to. So, is it Logan big? It costs 60 mil.
Well, a little overestimation there. It's 41 mil.
Oh.
Yeah.
I tell you what, if it hadn't have been pre-Omicron, it would have been 60.
It may well have been if Omicron hadn't come in there and sliced that right down. But of course, now we're going to the gross worldwide affair, Adam Richmond, for the film Dune. What do you think it did overall?
Well, they're spending a pretty penny on marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to make a lot over that and how much it cost for them to green light and make
the second film.
Part two.
Yeah. And a reminder that the budget was $165 million.
They're spending at least...
300?
80. So it's got to make, to clean its face...
It's got to make 300 minimum.
It's got to make 300. It's got to, like, let's say it made $450 million.
Oh, not far off, and you're closest so far to within the 10% allowance, just outside, though. $402 million it made.
Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
But it made money.
Well, did it, but yeah, maybe.
I think, yes, it did.
A bit of money.
Unless they spent $235 million on marketing. Which sounds like a lot.
It's been in development for so long. It made an amount of money that justified them making the sequel.
Bonus game to the box office game. There is a fantastic. I'm on boxofficemojo.com. There's a fantastic tool here which shows you the proportion of the overall take, the worldwide take that was domestic. So they mean US, right? Versus foreign. And in the case of Spider-Man No Way Home, 42% of that $1.9 billion came from the domestic US market. Just over a billion came from foreign. So would you like to guess how much, as a proportion of the audience for Dune, came from the domestic US market? as a percentage?
That's a great question.
Because it's a big film, but did the Americans like it as much as they liked Spider-Man, for example? And that, there's your tell. Spider-Man's 42% US.
I think it would be more like 25 for June.
Oh, Papa Richmond strikes again. 26.9%. 73% of the audience of the take for Dune was from foreign markets.
That's low, man, for that kind of film.
For Spider-Man?
No, sorry. Dune got, for its opening weekend, got 40.
Yeah.
That's low for what they would have wanted.
Yeah.
But, and the only reason, and I remember that this is, remember the world we lived in? Post one lockdown, staring another lockdown down the face.
Yeah.
Are people going to go out anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And Dune is the canary in the coal mine.
Yes.
Is it going to do? Has it got legs?
Is it going to do? Initially, has it got legs?
Initially, off the US, it wouldn't have got greenlit.
No.
A sequel. But it rolled out, man. Everyone across the world, we held hands across the world and we all willed it into existence.
Agree.
But they did also release it, I'm pretty sure, HBO day and date on streaming, which possibly might have affected things as well.
It might, may well have done. Well, another thing to say just from this before we move on, there are two films, I mean, there are more that are 50% plus domestic market, but the two that are the biggest on this list, Ghostbusters Afterlife, 63% of the audience was US for that, which makes sense. Ghostbusters, a well-beloved American franchise. The other one, second most, A Quiet Place Part 2, majority US take.
Interesting, because it's not as good and...
Interesting.
But yeah, they just turned up because it's very American.
Because they like it more than anyone else does. Yeah. There you go.
Should we should we do the bit of the podcast where one of us reads out a list of films to try and catch out the other one on a film they forgot?
I'd absolutely love to do that. And I think it's your turn to read a list.
It is my turn. And I might be reading out things that people have said before, but we've agreed that we might want to do them.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
The Report.
I'd never seen it.
Panic Room. Oh, have I got you number two?
And do you know what? That is a film that I forgot, but I don't think I'd ever seen it. I just remember it being huge at the time. I honestly don't think I've seen it.
Right.
It's got Forest Whitaker in it.
It does.
Fuck's sake, maybe I have seen it. Let me just look at the trailer very briefly.
It really sounds like you've seen it. It's very apropos of us, you know, because we chat about The Killer and Fincher.
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. I just remember it being extremely popular when it came out and me not watching it.
Okay.
But that if I had, that would maybe have been the deepest movies you forgot that you've read. It's a really, really good suggestion.
So deep. It is good. Now, you tried to get me on this and I fobbed you off. On recollection, I think it's a great shout, and I'm gonna lob it back. The Italian Job remake.
I mean, I added that to my list, Adam, when I was only adding films that I'd forgotten that I forgot before I realised I was allowed to just get you. I think we should do that because I have not seen that for maybe 15 years, and it feels like one that was a real try at something.
It's the most forgettable. I've said, when we've picked a film, I've gone, oh, that's center canon. This is like, you know, we've shot the arrow right through King Arthur, right through The Recruit.
Yeah.
Bedoying center canon films you forgot. It's got a heady cast. Mark Wahlberg, Charlize Theron, Jason Statham's in it. We can talk about Jason Statham.
Also, the main thing I remember about this film, I think it's this film, is them in the scuba gear lifting out the gold bricks from the underwater safe. And I that's the only memory I have of it, because I remember looking at those golden bricks and thinking, yes, I love capitalism. Bring me the gold. Give it to me. You know, those sorts of feelings.
Yeah, I have zero memories. So
I'm really excited to watch that. That's going to be a great episode.
Well, I'm glad. I don't know. At the minute, I'm glad we're doing Italian Job remake. I could end up livid. But there's been a lot.
Try to remember to keep an open heart and an open mind about what the hundreds of people that worked on that film were trying to do, you know? One or two of them maybe were fobbing it off for the paycheck, but the majority of the people that ended up there on that production, they all had hopes and dreams, Adam. They all wanted to be part of a bigger story, of storytelling, of creativity, working in an industry where they could change people's lives for the better, give them a reprieve for the audience from the horror that is their own lives, you know? They all had good intentions, and that's what I like to think about when I'm going to be watching the Italian Job remake.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some lovely, there's some really recurring things. Directors and actors. Christian Bale keeps popping up.
Oh, you know, Mr. Bale.
There's certain actors who keep recurring. I think we're going to see certain, I think, long-term, big picture podcast, we want to reflect on who we've spoken about.
Yeah.
And is there something about certain actors and certain directors and certain genres even that make a film you forgot.
I agree.
I'm going to leave that hanging. I'm going to leave that thought. That's a seed for people to let it grow. Tend that seed. And hey, guess what? If you've got a film you think we forgot, or you know, want us to do, email us at moviesyouforgotyouforgot@gmail.com.
Yep.
Follow me on Letterboxd at Error of Ways. I'll follow you back. That's my motto. Find Joe on X. He's very searchable. Joe Devine. Just Google him. He's a big time. And that's us, isn't it? Is that us? We're all done. All right. Bye.
Bye.